Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, U.S. Naval Academy History Professor Wayne Shaw looks at the generalship of Robert E. Lee. This class is part of a course called The American Way of War. It's 50 minutes.
As you know, the topic of the class is sort of Robert E. Lee, and not just to talk about Lee's life and career, but to sort of assess his generalship, assess his command. All right. So the first thing, obviously, when you need to do something like this, and we'll do this with Grant on Friday. And remember, the reason I have the class structured this way is because, as we'll probably talk about later in this class, if you criticize or defend Lee, a lot of times it ends up being in comparison to Grant, right? And you probably notice that, for example, especially in the Weigley reading. But before we get to Grant, why don't we start with Lee? And a lot of this comes down to, if we're going to talk about how we assess a general, how we assess a commander's abilities, Mr. Wayne Cumming, the question then becomes, what's the criteria one uses for that, right? Now, does anyone in your readings think that Lee has no merits as a general whatsoever? Does anyone say Lee is terrible to everything? It's a rhetorical question. No. Okay. So what? All right. So what is the consensus? Even and in your readings, who's the critic? Which guy? Historian. The one. I had you read it for Monday. Remember for. Is Gallagher a critic of Lee?
No.
Yeah. Okay. He gives you all the critics, and then what does he say about them? He says they're wrong, right? He goes through all of them and says they're all wrong. Okay, Russell Weigley criticizes Lee. All right, but even Weigley says what good things about Lee? What do you mean by that?
He's very aggressive, you know, typical West Point-ish general.
Okay, all right, so everyone agrees that Lee sort of positive traits. Aggressiveness. So, what are some examples of that being a good thing?
When McClellan's pushing across the river, instead of like sitting back to face it, he moved forward and attacked, or moved on McClellan's flank,
okay.
Forcing.
Okay. And what happens? Who wins? Right. Is he successful, right? Okay. Because aggressiveness obviously can be a negative aspect, right? All right. So Lee is successfully aggressive. Right. So that would be the 7 days, the example you give there. What's usually we think of Lee's best, most important battle?
Second Bull Run.
All right. What else?
Chancellorsville.
Okay. So these are two great victories. All right. So everyone, this idea of a few. Remember, we talked about strategy, operations, tactics, right? So everyone at the operational level usually acknowledges. There's very rarely will any historian say Lee is not a good campaign general, right? And there you just look at his record and the victories he wins, right? At Second Manassas, he essentially routs Pope, right? At Chancellorsville, he does the same thing to Hooker. At the 7 days, the Federals are, how close are they to Richmond? Close enough to hear the church bells. They're literally on the outskirts of Richmond. And if Richmond had fallen at that point in the summer of 1862, what potentially probably would have happened to the Confederacy? Yes, right. Remember, that comes after Forts Henry and Donelson. That comes after the fall of New Orleans, which isn't actually talked anywhere in your readings, but it's actually also important. You probably remember that from HH 104. Lee turns the tide, right, and he wins those very large and very important victories. Right. Now, why is Lee also criticized for his aggressiveness, though, Mr. Rawl?
He lost a lot of men really early.
Yes. Okay, so Mr. McDaniels.
It wasn't really the type of war that the Confederacy could afford to fight.
All right, exactly. All right. Mr. Connors, you want to get in there? Okay. All right. So, explain.
A lot of the historians. I think it was a Shelby Foote was saying he theorizes that the Confederacy should have fought a guerrilla war campaign similar to what the rebellion did during the American Revolution.
Yes. Okay. Not necessarily Foote, but there are a lot of arguments that Lee should have engaged in something more like partisan operations. All right. And it's not just guerrilla operations. I mean, everyone acknowledges that the Confederacy really would have needed a conventional army. But what relative of Robert E. Lee is a lot of times compared to Lee as something that should have been done from the Revolution? Or which very famous important relative of Lee, admittedly by at some level remove? Washington. Yes, Washington. Right. Or Lighthearted. Yeah. All right. Does Washington act like Lee during the Revolution?
No.
What is Washington's one crucial priority?
To maintain
the army. Yeah, to maintain the army, okay? To keep the army intact. So that's Washington's strategy, is the Continental Army must survive. So how does that then affect his operational stance? I mean, what does Washington do then as a consequence of that?
Washington follows a Fabian strategy and preserves his army. Whereas Lee should have preserved his army, he knew he could win whatever battles he fought, so he just kept on fighting.
Exactly. All right. Okay. So, and you see the different. Now, I know I had you guys read the Weigley on Monday. Who does do a Fabian strategy and Weigley praises?
Johnston.
During what campaign?
Atlanta.
Okay. All right. Who criticizes him?
Confederates, the people.
Yes, okay, and do you remember who makes that argument? And it's sort of a rebuttal to this idea. All right, let me step back and recap, okay? And Sherman is marching on Johnston in 1864. Sherman is trying to take Atlanta, and what Johnston does is he fights essentially a delaying action. But even Weigley acknowledges that what in the end, even if you accept Weigley's account of Johnston's skill, and that is also somewhat to dispute. But if we assume, yes, Johnston did fight a masterful Fabian campaign, what still happens to Atlanta at the end of the day?
It falls,
right? And why does it? And why does Weigley say it falls? It's not because of Johnston's lack of skill. It's
Lee's refusal to give troops to the West.
That's the larger strategic problem, right? And for that reason, by the time the effective strategy is chosen, Johnston doesn't have. If you're trading space for time, Johnston doesn't have enough space to trade at that point. It's too late in the war to do that effectively. So what should have happened then? And this is called a counterfactual, right? All right. It's the what if. All right. And it's tightly related to the issue of Lee. Because if you say Lee's strategy is wrong, you must then give an alternative. And the alternative should give you a higher likelihood of success. Right? And you need to give a plausible alternative. Have any of you heard of the novel Guns of the South? Yes. What happens in Guns of the South?
I've heard of that. I hadn't read much.
Okay. What's crazy thing happens in it? Yes, South Africans invent a time machine, and they see the Civil War as a big headache for them because this is when apartheid still existed. And what great way of solving the issue than giving the Army of Northern Virginia AK-47s? And guess who wins the war? Well, yeah, okay, the Confederacy wins the war, and it's kind of a silly book. I think it's Turtle Doves. I've read pieces of it just for grins. I hope he isn't watching this, but he might be insulted. But no, it's kind of a nifty. If you look at the front piece of the book, it's got a rifle, musket, and an AK sort of cross and the traditional infantry symbol. All right. So obviously, that kind of counterfactual, space aliens invade, right? Those are off the table. Right. More plausible counterfactuals are something like taking actual things used during the war, right? In this case, the plausible counterfactual is Johnston during the Atlanta campaign and saying this is what Robert E. Lee should have done, right? Or the Confederacy as a whole should have done, or Washington, right? During the Revolution, right? Because you see here at least similar circumstances. All right. What are the similar circumstances between the American Revolution and the Confederacy's bid for independence? It's wrong.
It's a smaller army. However, like if the Confederates looked to the American Revolution, they would be able to realize that the smaller forces could still gain independency. They would still be able to gain independency.
Yes,
With the smaller force, it's possible.
But you have to husband your forces in the correct manner, right? You have to. Does Washington go around willy-nilly attacking? Not to say necessarily he's doing it. Mr. Connors.
Well, the goal isn't to completely defeat your enemy. It's just to exhaust them, to ruin public opinion. And for that, you don't necessarily need to completely crush their armed forces. You just need to frustrate them, which is what Washington did. Washington never really, with the exception of Yorktown, focused on one strong point. He took out, detachments.
Yeah.
He won moral victories, which is probably what Lee should have done, is, hit small points as opposed to focusing on the large army where you risk your army in exchange.
That's what I was trying to get at, to break down the enemy's will.
Work. Now here's a question. In defense of Lee, does Lee actually disagree, except for the means, does he disagree with the ends of breaking Northern will?
No.
But what's Lee's sort of argument on this issue?
He thinks the big battle, that's why he goes to Gettysburg, because he thinks it's the decisive battle of annihilation is going to get them the victory that they want and break Northern will. It's against Southern culture to do what all the historians say that he should have done. They would never have done that. They want the classic conventional battles.
And who makes that argument? That's exactly Gallagher. Yeah. Right, okay. Mr. Malley.
Well, in defense of the conventional battle, the South was also vying for recognition by Great Britain and France, and that probably wouldn't have happened quickly, if at all, if they had adopted a guerrilla strategy, which some people advocate.
But Washington's, a Southerner, and he managed to pull this off. It's not just constant avoidance of battle. It's constant avoidance of battle with small victories that you can hold up and make big victories. Suppress war.
Yeah, okay, and that's a fair point, and that's the Weigel criticism, that's probably the most powerful criticism, all right? I think Gallagher quite ably goes through the problems with guerrilla war for the Confederacy, and I would say first, there's recently a big book about guerrilla war recently came out by a guy named Dan Sutherland, and he actually thinks guerrillas are more important than other Civil War historians think. But even he acknowledges that in the end, it's actually important because it's so self-defeating, right? That guerrillas cause so many problems that actually makes Southern civilians angry with their own government because guerrillas become prone to a lack of control. And we don't really cover it much in this class. You probably have heard of Missouri and the sort of the craziness that occurs in Missouri. And from the perspective of Southern white civilians, it's guerrilla war is not a great option. Also, what crucial and very important institution, Confederate social institution, is very vulnerable to guerrilla
slavery.
Right? Slavery requires stability above all else. Right? And I know some of you have any of you taken Professor Kamoy's class on slavery? I know she offers one, right? Slavery requires legal sanction because one of the things about what makes slavery different than other forms of property is that slaves are also human beings and they have wills and they have the ability to run and the ability to leave. And unless you have a legal apparatus to catch them, force them, confine them, the institution was going to have a very hard time to survive. So I think, and Gallagher in this reading I think spends pages basically demolishing the guerrilla option. And also another reason why people will get obsessed about the guerrilla option after the 1960s.
Vietnam,
right? These attempts to compare, the Confederates should have been doing what Mao did. I mean, this is a problematic comparison, right? For obvious reasons. The more credible alternative is what Mr. Connors just did, or just what Weigley argued, which is that you have what part of the revolution is very partisan orientated?
The southern
part, right? But even there, I mean, who's, remember, there's Greene, and is Greene commanding partisans really? No, Greene is commanding regulars, and he's aided by, and he knows how to work with them, right? And then you've got Washington with a Continental Army, and you gave example of Yorktown, but even Yorktown really is a point of opportunity, really, right? He happens to have a British Army bottled up there, and he chooses to exploit that opportunity at that time. That's the more effective criticism of Lee, that what he should have done is fought this Fabian strategy and kept his army in one piece and used the Confederacy's vast size to his advantage, its massive strategic depth. All right. So this is, and you have other military historical examples, right? What helps do in Napoleon? What big country does he invade?
Russia.
And it's the same issue. It's too big. Your lines of supply become further and further extended. You get more and more worn down. The logistics become harder and harder. And that's potentially a problem that can be used against the Federals. You know, who repeats, Professor Love will talk about this a lot, who repeats the French error in Russia? The Nazis, right? Don't invade, yeah, right.
That it was actually the disadvantage of the Confederates that they picked Washington as their capital, not Washington, I mean Richmond as their capital, and not something farther south.
Yes, that is problematic, but I'll point out, and it's not your readings don't have a. Richmond is chosen partly because Virginia is so important. Virginia is the home state of so many American presidents, including Washington. Virginia is very large in terms of population. Richmond has. The Tredegar Iron Works, which was one of the few centers of Confederate industry. So Richmond's of extraordinary political importance. And that's one of the reasons why, and sort of to seal the deal to some degree, they moved the capital to Richmond. In retrospect, was it really such a good idea? No. But everyone early on thought the war would be short and they weren't thinking these things through. All right, Mr. Manley.
Going back to the whole size issue. Like, I mean, I'm sure that the Russians were very aware that their country is huge and that the winter would bog any invading army down. Is there any evidence that Southerners were aware, like, hey, we have a pretty large piece of real estate here if we can just survive?
Yes, and I think that some of the newer scholarship shows that there's more talk about a guerrilla partisan strategy by some people, by some Confederates, early in the war, and there's more criticism than we used to think of people like Lee for being too, well, what school does he come from? Your favorite institution on the Hudson, right? The place you love to hate, right? So, well, that's too strong a term, right? One team, one fight, right? But we're joint, we're purple, right? But the Confederate high command all comes from that same institution, West Point. And that's one of the reasons that's going to be off the table for them. That's not the way West Pointers fight, right? I think Gallagher has a quote. It's the same quote I use at the beginning of my book. And I'll repeat the story to you. You know, Alexander, after the Confederate army has clearly lost. Yes,
stand up. So you mentioned that it was not the way the South wanted to fight because they were all, like, part of them were from West Point, but wouldn't it have just been an advantage since the Northern generals were also from West Point, and they're just made, they'd had to make the decision to split between their state loyalties. So I don't see where the argument comes that it's not the way they wanted to fight, if they have, like, basically inside knowledge of how the North would be fighting strategically as well.
It's the West Point is the significance is that because it's the only way. Using organized armies for both sides is the only way they can imagine how to fight a war. So, because they think it's unethical to some degree to use a guerrilla strategy, right? And both sides, no matter which section you go with, right? You go to West Point, yes, you have a sectional loyalty, but you end up in a military institution that says this is the way soldiers appropriately fight. And that's a different issue than what your political allegiance is going to be, right? So that's what That to some degree imprisons them. But I also want to point out that's part of the reason. But part of the reason is that guerrilla warfare is also a lot more problematic than has all sorts of problems and complications that would probably have made it not a viable solution anyways, even if these guys did do that, even though some Confederates talked about it. That doesn't mean it would have worked.
Sorry, I believe there's actually quite a definitive book on that exact subject right there called West Pointers in the Civil War, which discusses
the same. Yeah, it does talk about some of those things, right? Okay, so Mr. Swain.
Is there an honor or integrity question with guerrilla warfare?
Yes, I mean, precisely. Okay, and it's not that the regular army folks have no experience with it. They do, because who do they fight before the war? The Indians. All right, they're all veterans of the Indian Wars, and they deal with guerrillas in Mexico. And so they think this is completely inappropriate. They're on the receiving end of all of this. They don't see this. It's, you know, this is fighting dirty for them, right? I mean, of course, for the Sioux, it's just the way you fight. So, I mean, you have got a culture clash here, right? But that's part of the. But yes.
I was gonna say, but with guerrilla warfare in Richmond being so close to the Union line, wouldn't that mean they would have had to sacrifice that if they wanted to?
That would have been a problem. Is that the capital? The capital is still of great political importance, right? It's also related to this issue of what do the Confederates want, right? They want to be recognized as a legitimate nation state, and losing your capital does not help your cause. There, Mr. Connors.
Philadelphia fell.
Fair enough. That's the past for during what war?
The Revolution.
Right. I mean, the United States loses capital. It loses its, you know, New York, and the Americans still win. I mean, that's a fair reprise.
But that's different because the Confederates were trying to keep their capital so that Great Britain would support their cause and recognize them also as their own sovereign state. So I think it's different because you have one mind in the Revolution, we're trying to become free of like oppression. And though the North sees the South as like a rebel group, the South sees themselves as breaking free of an oppression, and they want to be recognized as a sovereign state. So it's just different mindsets. The South wants to hold their capital because, like I said, they want to be recognized. So if they let their capital fall like the Revolution did with the Americans and Philadelphia, they feel like they're not going to have the support of Great Britain. America wasn't trying to have the support of anyone else. They just wanted Great Britain to get out of their land.
Yes, yeah, so look, Mr.
I mean, I don't think it's all that different. I think in the American Revolution, the Americans were looking for support from the French. And I think that was a vital aspect, was holding on to showing the French that they could beat the British, you know. And I think, like, was it Nathaniel Greene that at Fort Saratoga or Ticonderoga?
Well, Saratoga is the crucial battle, right? Saratoga is the crucial battle that invites that.
I mean,
that
wasn't it sort of kind of like a partisan battle? It was fought. It wasn't fought.
Yes, you're right.
They were able to garner support in a partisan battle from the French, right. So I think that's not a strong argument.
If you have partisans working with regulars, right? I mean, that's the pattern that works.
I mean, I think to contradict that, back in the American Revolution, the French were, I mean, to go in slang, they were kind of itching to get at the British, and so I think the United States, or America at that point, really didn't need, like, decisive victories as much as the Confederates did, because the French and the English, they needed their support, but they weren't really as dedicated towards defeating another power as the French were in 1776.
Mr. Schmelk, then I gotta move.
The Confederates have one thing working against them when it comes to the history of Europe, is the fact in 1776, 83, is that the British and the French are fresh off a war against each other, the French-Indian War, and they really hate each other. But in 1861, the Concert of Europe is in full effect in the middle of that century, and the Europeans want to do everything to not go to war with each other. So they don't want to pick a battle in North America when they're trying to avoid battles at all costs.
And also, fundamentally, the British and the French, and it's really the French who follow the British lead on this. The French have ambitions in Mexico and things like that, and partly because of the rapprochement you talk about in the 19th century. Really, the British will make the decision to come in when it seems to them that the decision has already been made. Right, because the British are really, because what does Britain have as a problem always in terms of intervening against the United States? Where has it been exposed? North Canada. Right. Okay. So which is hard to defend, which is far away. Right. So the recognition is an important thing, but the thought is really that the Confederates are going to have to win enough victories to prove that. Either win enough victories or prolong it long enough, whatever that means. And also, what's not mentioned in your readings, I should tell you too, there's also a big problem for the British, which is slavery. All right, slavery is an issue for them. All right, the British abolished slavery through a program of gradual emancipation, but at tremendous cost. Because of this incredibly important humanitarian, I think there was a movie made about this, Amazing Grace, right, about William Wilberforce. and the British are a little bit on the fence about some of these issues, but the British generally don't like slavery for the most part. And this is going to be a big problem for them, a big hurdle for them to advance beyond in terms of recognizing the Confederacy. But there's another group of people that we haven't talked about, and that's one of Gallagher's arguments. One of Gallagher's arguments is that, actually it has been mentioned, one of you said that. Gallagher says that Lee chooses a strategy partly to attack Northern public opinion, break its will, but what does it also feed into, which is very important?
Southern desire for large victories.
Right. What's the problem with a Fabian strategy in Gallagher's view? I mean, we'll talk about maybe some of the operational issues, but it also doesn't recognize, Mr. Roth.
Well, with Johnson, he got fired because he didn't win battles against Sherman. So if Lee would have done the same thing, Lee would have been sacked too, probably.
Yes. All right. And why is this important?
People want to know who's winning.
Yeah, I mean, it's cultural, Mr. Connors.
Well, that's why you fight spoiling battles. That's why you like Washington too was dependent on public opinion, which is why he did raids and he attacked small detachments when he could pick up a win and say, "Look at all these guys I beat."
That's a good point, and this is something.
I don't think it has to do with their relationship with Davis, because to say that he would have been sacked just because he wasn't doing anything is kind of a far stretch. Like, for example, if North Lincoln didn't fire half of his generals simply because of political reasons, who were not doing as well.
We're going to have to wait a while. I mean, sometimes he does, but McClellan's a good example of that. Lincoln doesn't like McClellan early on, and then eventually he gets rid of him. It takes him a while. All right. What's different, though, about American political culture between the Confederacy? I mean, I'm expecting you to remember a little bit about American history in the antebellum period and the Jacksonian period. You remember what we sometimes call that? Jacksonian what? What's the other word? Democracy. Okay. In Washington's era, public opinion is not as important. Remember, in the early American Republic, you had to have property to vote. By the time of the Civil War, it's well established that only white men vote, but the franchise has extended. Right? You have things like newspapers. You have a lot more public opinion. It's not that public opinion didn't matter in the American Revolution, but the reply, I think, to Mr. Connors is a strong argument there is that the Confederate public opinion matters more, right? The ability, and that perhaps spoiling fights wouldn't be enough, right? And I'll point out that Sherman, for example, remember that poem I had you guys read, right? That's at Kennesaw Mountain during the Atlanta campaign. That's where Sherman attempts a big charge, fails, suffers a lot of casualties. Johnston can, in theory at least, point to some local successes like that. And then what happens to Johnson? You guys have already said. He gets fired, right? Partly because he's perceived as being too passive and therefore insufficiently aggressive. And that the broad spectrum of Confederate public opinion, of which Davis is by necessity responding to, wants a more aggressive strategy. And Lee gives it to them, right? Mr. Connors.
At the same time, the Gallagher reading is full of this talk about how the Confederacy was willing to fight all the way until after Appomattox and onwards. You can't say, okay, we're going to be willing to fight all the way like this if we're not willing to take a strategy that is a little more cautious.
Okay, and this is a good example where strategies can collide with public opinion, right? This is why sometimes we call it, right, sometimes, that's why there's a division, right? So this is purely military, right? But that has to serve larger political goals, which are sometimes really rooted not so much in what's more militarily effective, but what is values, for lack of a better term, ideals, right? And is the most militarily effective goal always in perfect concert, always completely compatible with values and ideals? No, right? And there's always a process of negotiation that occurs between the two, right? If you go too far, I mean, I know this is not necessarily something that your ethics class wants to hear. If what happens when they clash and one puts too much weight on the ideals? What's the cost then? You lose. Yeah, you lose, right? On the other hand, a lot of times, even military organizations don't want to do any, you know, it's not anything goes, right? Because there's a sense that you've compromised what you wanted so much that you've now, what's the point of this victory? You know, the victory becomes hollow from a moral, political, and ethical stance. And the two are frequently in collision, and the two frequently collide. And this may be an example. I mean, if Weigley is right, and this is a way of maybe saying that, in a sense, both Weigley and Gallagher are right. You know, Gallagher is right when he talks about what Confederate public opinion wants, when he talks about the imperatives of Southern white culture, right? Weigley may be correct from a strategic perspective, a military strategic perspective, that the more plausible military strategy is the Fabian strategy, right? They may be both right, but that's arguably perhaps the Confederacy's biggest problem, is making those two compatible, right? Okay. So then now we circle back, right, to Lee. All right. You know, do we think of Lee as someone whose strategy, well, here's this. Do you think Lee's strategy was plausible?
No.
Mayor Emmert, say why.
No, because the South never had enough men or enough industry to compete with the North. The North was too big of a power. I forget who, I think it was in the Gallagher reading, I forget who he was quoting as saying that the North fought with a hand tied behind their back.
Shall we fight? Yeah.
And so just the juggernaut of Northern industrialization and manpower would have overwhelmed the South regardless. Plus, I think one of Lee's biggest problems was he was too oriented on Virginia and his home state, and that caused him to completely neglect the West when he could have perhaps shifted some troops out there and helped thwart some of the Southern defeats there. So he did well for himself for the most part in Virginia, but he sacrificed the West, and I think that really hurt the South.
Okay, and that is an argument that hasn't come up, and that is another criticism of Lee. And, well, let me let Roth and Manley get in, and then we'll...
Was it just the North that thought it was going to be a short war? Because if the South believed it was a short war, then all the casualties and its aggressive campaign wouldn't have mattered so much down the line when, in the late 60s, they were coming up to the end of the war and they were running out of men. If the aggressive campaign would have paid off early in the war, then it wouldn't have mattered later on.
Yes, and you know what? That is actually Lee's reply, sort of, to... Lee would acknowledge everything you've just said about Northern superiority, but he would actually then turn that to support his strategy. I need to win the war early, because eventually it will become a matter of time, and then we'll definitely lose, precisely for the reasons you just said. So it's sort of that, you know, the only chance for victory is to gamble early. And he gambled and he lost. But you can still say, well, that's the only viable strategy. Although, well, okay, both of you want
to... Yeah, I was going to go back to the, you know, grand versus military strategy thing. I think that it was a plausible strategy. If they had won a few more key, if they had defeated the North at Antietam and not given Lincoln a platform for the Emancipation Proclamation, if they had, you know, won Gettysburg and hindered Lincoln's chances for re-election in 1864, I mean, things like that would have worn down Northern will and kept out foreigners long enough to have gained the South. So I think it could have won. It's just... Fortunately, things that go well in the battlefield won.
My big thought is my criticism of Lee comes when he finally does switch to the defensive, which he's forced to because his offensive plans before the Wilderness, which are kind of, I would call them fever dreams almost, because he thinks he can still move with the kind of speed and achieve the kind of depth that he did when he still had a functioning or well-functioning offensive army. He makes all kinds of failures in these initial kind of defensive battles, especially at the angle at Sharpsburg, which I guess is a tactical failure less than it is a strategic failure. But
yeah, although, I mean, I think consensus is Lee does pretty well during the Overland campaign, but he does it too late. And that his army is bled white by that time, and therefore it's not. It's by that point, he's already wasted so many men. That's part of the argument against his generalship in that case. Let's show to. I mean, how many of you do think Lee was plausible? Let's just show hands. I'm just curious. Plausible that his strategy was plausible. Okay, so most of you think it was plausible. All right. What did people think about the argument Weigley makes this about his Lee's victories being hollow?
Because he'd always he'd suffer massive casualties to achieve them.
What?
They were hollow because, as in with Gettysburg, he'd win the battle and he'd hold the land through the day of the battle, but then the next day he'd have to leave anyway because the logistics couldn't keep up with it.
Well, yeah, or even better example, you know, Gettysburg's really just a loss. I mean, where the big battles he won again? Remind us, Chancellorsville,
Second
Manassas. Does the Federal Army completely dissolve? No, right? It's at times, especially in the case of Second Manassas, it's in terrible shape. But it's not like he walks into Washington unopposed, right? He mauls the Federals tremendously. But he's still, that's why he always needs the follow-on victory. That's why you have the Antietam campaign. That's why you have the Gettysburg. He wants the follow-on. That you need the three, right? But let's say he wins at Gettysburg, right? What does he do? I mean, what, right? He wins at Gettysburg. And he loses a third of his men in the process. He's still got the logistical problem. He still has all these sorts of issues. And this is an argument against Lee, and one that should be considered. And part of it also relates to how plausible, though, you think that Gettysburg, and that whether or not he really could have won Gettysburg and Antietam. Mr. Goodman.
I think the problem is that his strategy. I personally don't think his strategy was flawed. I think it was fine, and that's what it was needed for the South to win. But I think the problem goes back to his positive trait was also another one of his weaknesses, was his aggressiveness, because he became way too reckless with his men. And when he saw the tide of certain battles starting to change, he would just throw more men into the battle and they'd just get mowed down. But it would work to wear down the North.
All right. And that's Samer.
I have issue with sort of his strategy going into Gettysburg, because the point of his campaign was obviously he wanted to win a big battle in the North as a moral victory and reduce the will, but wasn't the military objective was to get to Harrisburg, right? Wasn't that because there was the rail hubs there and that's what he was going for? Gettysburg just happened to be where the armies ended up meeting.
He does not intend to fight at Gettysburg. He intends to fight somewhere in the North, yeah.
So if he's going after a transportation hub like Harrisburg or an industrial center, so what? I mean, you make it, and even if he was to take over a rail hub or factories,
I would say his goal is really to force the Federal Army to a battle, and to defeat it decisively. And that by itself should crush Northern public opinion. All right, and it's not completely. Let me throw this out. What happens in New York City around that time?
The draft riots.
Okay, the North is deeply, deeply divided in some respects about the war. So imagine draft riots plus the prospect of, but you know, the reality is though this is all terribly complicated. For example, you guys got the traditional explanation historians use. Why is Sherman's Atlanta campaign so important to Lincoln? The capture.
Because it turns public opinion to Lincoln election of 1864.
Yeah, right. We have a famous letter from Lincoln where he says, "I'm going to lose this election." Who's Lincoln's opponent? This is actually not in any of your readings.
McClellan
of all people. Now, McClellan is on a platform that the Democratic Party platform. I mean, they've got parts of the Democratic Party which want to declare kind of an armistice in the negotiations. And the thought is, if you do an armistice, so the Confederates basically won, right? That a lot of these Northerners, that the so-called peace Democrats, don't realize that the Confederates really want their independence. They think that if you do a ceasefire, you can renegotiate this. And the Confederates sometimes talk openly about how they want to encourage this misperception. I mean, these knuckleheads think this, but of course, we really just want our own country at this point. But if you stop, you're not going to be able to start the machine back up again, right? This will become a fait accompli. But McClellan's own position is somewhat different, so we really don't completely know, in all honesty, what McClellan would have done. I mean, McClellan, he was not in favor of emancipation, but McClellan was a Union man still. And McClellan would have been president. So that dynamic might have, is that counterfactual is problematic. And that's another, and this is related to a larger question, all right? This is not just about Lee. This is about how much chance does the Confederacy as a whole have at victory. If you come up with so many barriers to Confederate victory, then anything Lee does perhaps is impossible, if that Shelby Foote line is right. Okay, whether or not you buy that. But that's a, and you see the questions are related. If you say Confederate victory is too many things are against it, then this is almost a stupid question. We shouldn't have this class, in all honesty. Then we should have a class about, then I should just be writing out tables of manpower and industrial capacity and things like that. All right.
On like Lee's, like, you know, like Confederate strategy. I mean, this is in retrospect, obviously. We see like how good he is at like the defensive strategy when he's forced to do that. And I mean, just wouldn't it have made more sense to do that because they'd been closer. You know, they'd been in the Confederacy, which is the size of Europe at the time. They'd been closer to like their supply lines. They had more logistics. And they could have given up land and maybe at the same time like broken Northern public opinion and will, while you know still giving up, you know, small amounts of property, not losing the massive amount of casualties that in the, you know, aggressive Northern campaigns that he embarked on.
Mr. Roth, I'll let me.
Didn't he go to the North because the South was like losing all the supplies? They didn't have like the food stock and all that.
Yes.
So they went to Pennsylvania, they just took advantage of all the fields there.
Yeah, a lot of it's just you know, a lot of the supply system is sort of legalized theft, right? And the Federals do the same thing. Right? I mean, and the Confederates partly. I mean, Northern Virginia is completely devastated. It's sort of completely opposite of what you think of Northern Virginia now as being this nice, prosperous place. Oh, you know, Gallows Road, you know, with funny street names. But that's part of the supply. There is a supply imperative there, right? But of course, Lee does well in the Overland campaign. But he's always, what's interesting about the Overland campaign is he's doing exactly what he doesn't want to do, and then the interesting question then becomes, you know, is he just personality-wise unsuited to fighting that? Also, Gallagher makes this point. Let me point this out, too. Lee fights a masterful delaying action in the Overland campaign. Johnston, if Weigley is right, fights a masterful delaying action during the Atlanta campaign. But what happens at the end of all these things? You still lose. All right? Why? Because what happens? You're pushed back, and then what happens? What kind of operation occurs that plays to all the federal advantages? A siege, all right? And Lee says that very early on. He says this very early on. If this becomes a siege, we're done, all right? Because, and he says this as early as the 7 days, because if McClellan can bring up his heavy artillery, all the Northern superiority and logistics and material, it's just gradually going to overwhelm the Confederacy, and therefore sieges have. And what happens after a siege? What happens after things like Donelson, Henry, Vicksburg?
You lose all your troops.
Yeah, you lose an entire army. I mean, you have a whole. And so that's one of Gallagher's arguments against this: is the stuff doesn't actually work, right? Because Mr. Connors, you want to?
I'm going to say I think there's definitely something to do with the opposing generals. He's got a really good read on people like McClellan or even Burnside. Burnside has this problem where he'll freeze up when he's given too much. It's shown in kind of Burnside Bridge. He takes him a long time to get across that bridge. Burnside can be taken advantage of and exploited, as can McClellan, obviously. McClellan will break if pushed right, but he doesn't get that good a read when it comes to Grant.
Yes, I think, and also what should be added is a good read on the Army of the Potomac. All right. There's something deeply wrong about the Army of the Potomac, historians think. And I don't know if historians have done a great job. I mean, even guys like Bruce Cannon talk about this. The Army of the Potomac fights really hard. Its rank and file are pretty effective. But its generals, and it's a kind of an organizational problem. It's partly because of McClellan, because a lot of the officers he selects and the culture he creates is a very defensive, passive-minded one. And also, it's sort of like the sports team that gets beaten by the same team too often, right? I mean, there seems to be a sense that they get the culture of losers, right? And what's the opposite thing in the Army of Northern Virginia? They think they're always going to win. And what's interesting about it is one, it's not just the Army thinks that. Who else thinks that? And Gallagher has a lot of evidence of that.
The Army of Potomac thinks that.
That's part of it. And what other important group of people? The Confederates, average Confederate. So even when you look at things like Gettysburg, what's interesting is how Gettysburg is a defeat for Lee, but the public reaction is not that negative. It's sort of, well, yeah, we wish it went better, but the first day went for the Confederacy. And where did it happen? In Pennsylvania. So, okay, so we didn't get a huge victory there, but we fought the Federals to a draw. We survived. The first day went better for us. Okay, Vicksburg is seen as a complete disaster in contrast. No one says Vicksburg's good. The same thing occurs to some degree after Antietam, which Lee's army is mauled, but he stays an extra day and is able to kind of say, this is a draw, and McClellan doesn't attack him. That's partly McClellan, right? Lee almost dares McClellan to attack the day after the battle, and McClellan makes a mistake and refuses. He could probably destroy Lee's army on the spot. But there is a, and this is the importance of psychological factors. And if you're going to defend Lee the way Gallagher does, you're going to put heavier premium on these things. That Lee is able to build this culture of winning, so he has to take risks. And there are positive effects to this. So as late as 64, the Army of Northern Virginia is still going to be a very effective fighting force, partly because of this culture of winning that was built before. But you wouldn't have built that culture of winning if you had done the Fabian strategy that Washington would have done, right? Because men aren't going to be, I mean, yes, you can rationally explain it to them. Mr. Connors, you want to push back on that?
Well, I mean, a culture of winning is as useful as it is, but even the Army of the Potomac, I think the description of them is like a bulldog who's been whipped a lot, is used to getting whipped, but is always going to keep fighting and keep fighting pretty hard.
And will eventually win.
And will eventually win. So there's a culture of tenacity that I think develops in the Army of the Potomac, whereas the Army of Northern Virginia, when they lose, yes, they still have a culture of always winning, but that loss somehow will stick with them, I think.
Well, I'll stick them with them because they might have a culture of winning, but so many of them will be killed and won't matter. Right? Arguably that is what happens to the Army of Northern Virginia. At the end of the day, the best troops in the world, if they're half starved because their supply lines are cut, they're running low on ammunition, and there aren't that many of them left. And by 65, what has happened to a lot of your best officers? They're all dead. Right, or wounded, or lame, this happens on the federal side, too, especially after the Overland Campaign. Eventually that preponderance of military, of material. But again, this is an argument for why Confederate independence is very hard to get in the first place. Right, so the question is this even a good discussion to have? Right, and I just wanted, so I'm just throwing that out there, okay? I think most military historians, though, and perhaps it's just because we're military historians, don't think that the Confederacy's victory or Confederate defeat is automatic. All right, I think most of us come to the agreement that Lee came close enough to changing the tide of the war by winning. He came close enough to the hat trick. We have to take this seriously, right? That being said, you can still make the argument, like Weigley does, is that, well, that was one way of getting victory, but there's another way of getting victory, and that way would have been something more like Washington, something more like a Fabian strategy, and that would have been more operationally effective. But remember, that might be true. Weigley might be right in military terms, but if Gallagher is right about the power of public opinion, then that's still not a viable strategy. That's still not something that would have actually been a workable thing. All right, so keep a lot of this stuff in mind. We're going to get to Grant on Friday. And we'll talk more about that, but Mr. Guerrero. All right, leave.
More from U.S. Naval Academy history professor Wayne Shaw as he examines the generalship of Ulysses S. Grant. This class is part of a course called The American Way of War. It's 50 minutes.
So, today we will do Grant. With Lee, obviously, one of the ways that class was structured was you had, obviously, one historian who thought Lee was an excellent battlefield general and a terrible strategist, and then you had another historian, my former teacher, Gary Gallagher, who made the argument that, no, Lee's strategy was plausible. It didn't work out, but it wasn't because his strategy was implausible or not well executed. Today is what you might have noticed is I didn't really give you an anti-Grant reading, meaning Grant is terrible. And the reason for that is the consensus view amongst most modern historians is that Grant was a great general. I mean, that really is the debate. I mean, not everyone's going to agree with that. There's always issues for debate. But the current scholarship is extraordinarily positive. I more or less subscribe to that view. And it's hard to get a really good Grant the Butcher reading that some of you have heard this term. Give you a current reading like that that's actually plausible. All right, so I don't. But I should mention that. I mean, historiography, meaning the changing interpretations about the past, Grant's example is very interesting about that, because Grant, during the war, right after the war, what happens to Grant, you know, after the war, that shows how Americans like him. He becomes president. He's incredibly important. He writes, his memoirs are, how many of you actually read pieces of Grant's memoirs? Look, a few of you, right? Maybe even in an English class. I mean, Grant is, and even in the history of American prose style, Grant is important because we call it the plain style, the type of writing we teach, the very kind of unvarnished, clear, taking out a lot of the rhetorical flourishes we associate with Victorianism, with Romanticism. Grant actually has something to do with that. So Grant's reputation is very high. And then you have this turn where people become sort of indifferent to him, and you even get a very powerful, driven in large part by the writings of former Confederates, where Grant is portrayed as Grant the Butcher. So for those of you who've heard that, I think a few of you have, and what's the criticism of Grant? And you can also draw that out of Wigley, although he clearly sees Grant as still a great general. I mean, what's the complaint about Grant, you think?
Kind of throws his men away.
Yes, okay, that Grant is extraordinarily bloodthirsty. You know, and you get all sorts of stories, things like, supposedly Grant liked his meat very well cooked, partly because he had worked in a tannery at one point. And, you know, the criticism, well, you know, there's this bloodthirsty general who can't stand the sight of blood, but who wastes his men and things like that. So you get all this very, very negative, very hostile interpretation. And then really around the time of the interwar period, a few important British military writers really start to rehabilitate Grant and who see him as a much more important general and give the interpretation that Wigley more or less repeats here. And what you got in Wigley's reading is kind of the consensus view, although there will be people will dispute pieces, including myself, and adjust things here or there. But that's more or less the general view. All right. So, but you should realize that Grant's reputation has ebbed and flowed. And I still want you to sort of make an evaluative judgment. But it does tend to inspire less debate than Lee. All right. And I wouldn't be surprised if this class is affected to some degree about that. Or maybe it isn't. All right. So, why don't we step back after giving you that little bit of context? Why don't some of you start fleshing out why is Grant, at least in the reading you got, why is Grant a great general? What makes him special?
He wins.
Okay, all right. That is a great opening line. You've kind of advanced the class in a way. I wanted to get to that issue, right? I mean, this sounds preposterous, right? But there's a reason why Grant's reputation is always going to be easier to defend than Lee's. Because he wins the war, right? And Lee doesn't.
Sir, Wigley also argues that he's like this long-term, like he sees the bigger picture of things. It's not this like instantaneous battle where he has to his ultimate goal is to crush Lee's army, but he sees like the bigger picture of the war.
Okay. If at that level of three, what are those three levels of war again? Right, strategy, operations, tactics, right? And all right, Grant is the master strategist. Does Grant always get his way at the operational and tactical level?
No.
All right. Does anyone remember an example? It's one of them are you reading. What happens at Shiloh? Is that Grant's greatest battle, really?
No.
Because what? Well, what happens? Yes, okay, the federal army is, and Sherman has some doing with this. The Union army is basically caught napping to some degree. All right. But how does Grant retrieve the situation? Wigley sort of refers to it as a certain character trait.
just kind of holds in
there. Yeah, Grant doesn't panic. All right, so he recovers, all right, but it doesn't mean that he's flawless operationally. It doesn't mean that he's flawless tactically. All right, Mr. Connors, did you?
I think his thing is that he's got the nerve. McClellan breaks and Burnside breaks. All these other generals break, but Shiloh, he doesn't break. The Wilderness, when he actually gets his flanks, he gets outflanked, he doesn't break, he just withdraws and stabs again.
Yeah. And how does that relate to having the big picture? How do those two connect?
He knows if he loses this battle, it doesn't necessarily mean he's done with it.
Yes.
So he's able to get over the fact and move on to the next one.
Okay, so there you have here, and this is a traditional military historian's argument about why you focus on generals, right? Wigley uses it. Who's the contrasting figure to Grant on this question of character? Who's the guy who gets the strategy right, but due to a moral failing, I mean, that's basically the way 19th century Americans were seeing it, doesn't succeed? It's McClellan, right? Or if you notice, what's Wigley's evaluation of the strategic concept of McClellan's peninsula campaign?
It's pretty positive.
Yes.
It's just he didn't have the guts to follow.
Yeah, exactly. All right, that is what. And not only that, what does Wigley talk about? How does he characterize McClellan's political ideas?
He was a lot less revolutionary than, well, the Civil War seemed to turn out like. He would have rather had the Civil War carried out so that there weren't any changes, slavery wasn't touched, and the Union was restored how it was.
Yeah. And whether or not that was really a good or bad thing, is it plausible in Wigley's view? Mr. Roth, did you say something?
I said it wouldn't be plausible to bring the Union back together, in that opinion, because the South was in their own mindset. Like, you know, they wanted the war to end, and they wanted to stay the same way they were.
Okay, Wigley is kind of on the fence. I think if you read his other work, there's a sense in Wigley that battle and wars, there's a lot of downsides to them. So he clearly has a fondness for McClellan's desire to have a military strategy that leaves civilians alone and things like that. And Wigley doesn't seem to care a huge amount about slavery, arguably. So that's one of the reasons why he can take that position. But I think you're right, Mr. Roth, to also say that other points, Wigley seems to indicate that's politically that strategy probably wouldn't have worked also. I mean, that there was something deeply implausible about it. But that it becomes completely implausible because McClellan fails on the battlefield, right? His only chance to make his political strategy work requires him to achieve a military victory, which he does not, right? And then you're replaced with the Grant strategy, which is much more... So Grant has the better strategic conception, but let's flesh out then. Let's step back again. He's got the good strategic view, but what's his strategy in Wigley's view? And it's the title of the chapter, right? The strategy of annihilation. What does that mean?
Destroy the army.
Okay. So how are the different ways of doing that? Mr. Roth.
He was going to follow... the big thing is he had people follow Lee's army. And they just keep picking off people at a time and follow him and just make Lee, like, make the mistake.
Okay, so, Mr. Goodman,
I was going to say, as well as it's not just following Lee's army as well as Johnson, he divided his forces to engage the Southern armies at the same time on multiple fronts.
Okay, so you have various examples, right? You have attrition. What's that a fancy term for? It's what Mr. Roth just said to someone.
Just keep killing.
In this case, it can't. You can associate it with guerrilla warfare. That's true. But in this case, it's wearing down your opponent, and that's the overland campaign with a lot of fighting, a very high casualty count. All right. But as Mr. Goodman, you're probably thinking of a different. Did you mention the Vicksburg campaign? I think.
No, not this time, sir.
All right. But I mean, that's an example where Grant doesn't wear down his opponent through a heavy casualty sort of grinding away. What does he do instead there?
Carried out a siege, but originally when he first started at Vicksburg, then he launched two or three assaults and failed at that. So, I mean, one could argue that he tried to annihilate Southerners or the Confederate Army in Vicksburg too, which just
he does. But in the end, he does win, though, right? The assaults don't work, but the siege. How does the siege conclude? Yeah. Okay. Where else does Grant achieve maneuver that leads to siege to decisions by siege?
Petersburg.
That's actually another one. That's true. Although it's not really maneuver that gets him there, arguably, right? Although he tries to get there. Yes, Forts Henry and Donelson. Right. Also, What makes Grant innovative about some of those? This is the inner service thing. What's Grant? Yes.
He forced an unconditional surrender from a lot of the.
But what service helped him out?
You're right.
The Navy.
Right. Okay. So, and what other campaign is the Navy very useful for him?
The West.
In the West. So Henry, not Vicksburg. Okay, it's Vicksburg who runs him Bass. You guys probably hopefully remember that from HH-104. Right. So you have here, the goal is to annihilate, at least in Weigling's interpretation, Confederate military power by destroying armies. But you notice the way to destroy armies, there are multiple versions of it. Right? What does Grant not always seek for? And this is why Weigley sees him as so praiseworthy.
He doesn't always look for a battle.
Yes.
He actually criticizes Scott for going through unnecessary battles and losing men when he could have gone around objectives and still abstained.
In what earlier war?
The Mexican War.
Exactly. Who is the exponent of a Napoleonic strategy in Weigley's view? It's a chapter you read before that in the book.
Lee.
So Grant wants to destroy, I mean, and I want you to understand this, because when Weigley says a strategy of annihilation, he's not meaning necessarily a battle, right? Because battles are at the operational and tactical level, right? He's meaning, in this case, he's basically saying there are other ways of achieving that objective which are more effective, and generally, especially the option of maneuver leading to siege, are far less costly, right? What's the other thing that we've put up, that hasn't been put up here, and it involves this issue of non-combatants?
Mr. Ron?
Take away all the supplies.
Yes. Okay. All right. Attacks on, and how do you do that? Let's not sugarcoat it.
You attack fields, you attack villages.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that is, it is you move through the countryside, you take what you can consume, which you also, why do you also need to do that? You have to feed your army. And, well, what's the alternative, though? What's McClellan's alternative to feeding your army? You don't have to take stuff from civilians to feed your army. The American military doesn't do that nowadays. Yeah, you have to live off extended lines of supply. Or you can do things like you can actually pay people. Right? I mean, the Confederates do this in Gettysburg. They give people vouchers, and you can get paid in Confederate money. Right, I mean, the Federals could have done this. And don't take that to... In the 18th century, European armies sometimes do this seriously, by the way. People actually get compensated for the stuff. Right? But by Grant's... Late in the war, the Federals are not doing that anymore.
Okay. However much those Confederate dollars are worth.
Well, I mean, U.S. dollars probably would have been worth more, right? But it's asking a lot for... You know, you're not being terribly respective to Southern white civilians if you're paying them in currency that they don't see as legitimate, right? So, but they're not even bothering with that fig leaf. They're just taking the stuff, and what they can't consume, what happens to it? It's deliberately destroyed, right? By the way, Weigley, I want to give you a sense here. Weigley is the consensus view in the historiography around nowadays is that, yes, there's a lot of deliberate destruction of civilian property. Yes, this is by no means a sugar-coated thing. But generally, civilians are not killed. The incidence of things like rape and sexual assault is very low, especially when you compare it to other conflicts, at least with white civilians. African-Americans, unfortunately, becomes a different issue. But even then, relatively low. And measures are made. We don't really also have a lot of evidence of mass starvation during the Civil War. I mean, there just isn't much evidence of that. So people have to flee for their lives, and their livelihoods are destroyed, but they eventually find a place where they can get food. And we even have evidence that the federal army will, for example, leave enough that people won't starve, but they'll destroy everything else and be really rude and obnoxious about it. All right. But that's, you know, this is this issue of, you know, attacking the Confederate economy. And Grant is the overall, part of the overall mastermind of this, but in Weigley's view, who is the person who really executes this to the farthest degree? Sherman. Right? But obviously Grant is a part of this set of schemes. Right? So here you have some of the different methods of annihilating Confederate military power. okay, that Grant embarks on, and which Weigley sees as, if nothing else, successful. Right? And that's the argument. All right, that at the strategic level, that is where Grant's exodus comes in. And not only that, he has the personality traits. Now, this is why in military historians' views, generals still do matter. Right? You can be like McClellan and have a plausible strategy at least. But if you can't execute it, because in McClellan's case, at least, you sort of he loses his nerve, then the game is up for that strategy. It's not going to be operationally effective. All right. Let me step back. This is Mr. Schmelich's point. Grant is on the winning side of the war, right? But someone give me an argument as to, okay, so what? I mean, why is that not necessarily mean that he's a good general?
We don't populate the South.
Yes, right. If you know, you've got to. This is all right, Mr. Roth. Why don't you elaborate on that more?
I think there was like a line in the book that said that we had more people at the peak of the Union military than the Confederates had in general.
All right. Okay. Some other.
I mean, the North is a lot more industrialized than the South was.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, and so how much credit do we give generals for having bigger resources, right? Here's another issue, we haven't really talked about this even with Lee. Who does Grant fight in the West where he makes his career? I mean, is this the best Confederates have to offer? No, right? None of you can probably remember these folks. Guys like, well, Weigley likes Joe Johnston a lot, right? But, you know, but Grant's, I mean, people like... Braxton Bragg, Pemberton. You know, this is sort of this rogues gallery of ineptitude in auto honesty in the Confederacy, right? How can one use the same argument that great generals require sort of inept opponents in Lee's case? This is the same issue in evaluating Lee. Who does Lee fight?
Allen, Burnside. Yeah.
You know, Joe Hooker, right? Okay. Right, the Army of the Potomac in general, right? But arguably, the Army of Tennessee is perhaps an even worse army than the Confederate Army of the Tennessee is an even worse army than the Union Army of the Potomac, right? So, and when I say that, I mean things in terms of, you can actually make that argument because the Confederate Army of the Tennessee is plagued, and we don't have time to cover that in this class. Well, maybe some of you did in Professor DeCretico's. Is it a happy relationship within the army, the Confederate Army of Tennessee's high command?
No, it's a mess.
Right. Well, because what's going on?
The generals like each other.
Yes.
They're all at each other's throats.
Yeah. And Davis never adjudicates the issue, right? Davis probably should have picked one side and fired everyone else, right? Because you have essentially a corrupted command climate. Instead, he stays with Bragg for too long, but he doesn't fire Polk, who's the leader of the anti-Bragg faction. So they're all attempting to undermine Bragg, and it's just sort of this, and Bragg's sort of this difficult human being. You know, we think he might have had stomach problems, maybe he'd been really cranky and things like that. So you've got great stories. There's a great story, for example, of Braxton Bragg in the old army, the antebellum army, of how he had to be dual-hatted. He was, I think, a line officer, and he was, I think, the quartermaster of his company. That happened a lot. You had to do double duty. The army was very small. And he actually sent a requisition to himself as a line officer that he then rejected as a staff officer. I mean, this story is probably apocryphal. It's probably fake, but it says something about, I mean, Grant relates the story. It says something about what everyone knew about Braxton Bragg. And supposedly his superior said, you know, sir, you have quarreled with everyone else in the army, and now you have quarreled with yourself, right? I mean, it's sort of this, I mean, that's who you have as the primary Confederate field commander for a long time. And then, as you know, in the case of Lee, as you probably know more, you have folks like McClellan. And McClellan, actually, in all honesty, looks pretty good compared to Burnside. Right. So, well, he doesn't do very well, though. Right. So, all right. So you have here a success of numbers. And it comes back to this issue, is how much can we really put, how much credit can you really give to an individual general for their success or failure? And how much of it is due to circumstances beyond their control, whether it be who happens to be their opponent, whether it is what happens, what's the material resources they can call upon, what's the political restrictions they're operating under, right? What's the institutional structures? Ms. Denard.
During the time period, like what time of the war were they in? Because certain years of the war, there were there was less likely for their troops to run away and flee. And then other times they just weren't feeling it. They weren't as dedicated to the cause or the cause that they didn't see for that.
And these are things that no individual can control. I mean, some people have, even those who are very pro-Grant have acknowledged, what's good about him being sort of the obscure Western theater early in his career? Why? He gets less political interference. He gets less exposure. So he can make mistakes. If Grant had done Shiloh in the East very early on, what probably would have happened to him? Erwin McDowell, by the way, at Bull Run, does okay, arguably. Erwin McDowell's army is very motivated, but terribly inept. And that's actually not McDowell's fault. And it's a close call. But what happens by necessity to McDowell after losing the first battle when everyone expects to win it? He gets fired. And McDowell's career never quite recovers. It's not as if, I'm not saying that McDowell was some great general, but McDowell, even as a corps commander, is always going to be plagued by this sense of you're the guy who lost the first battle, even though really rationally, it wasn't really just his fault. I mean, a lot of things went wrong, and he for someone with his level of inexperience, which is true of everyone else, he did okay, right? Lee is like this, too. Does Lee do so great in Western Virginia? He does terrible, right? Why is Lee even put in command of the army, what later becomes the Army of Northern Virginia?
Johnson gets injured.
Johnson takes a bullet and is literally incapacitated, right? Where's the other four-star, right? He happens to be in Richmond. Put him in command. The rest is history, right? Lee has nothing to do with that. And you can make the same argument about various episodes in Grant's career, right? So most of you know a little bit, you know, what's Grant's antebellum career like?
It wasn't great.
He does pretty good in Mexico. He has an excellent combat record in Mexico. But then the very boring world of a regular army garrison life becomes problematic, and some of you probably heard of Grant's. What did Grant like to imbibe? Right? I mean, that's sort of some issues with alcohol, and it's still controversial if that ever comes up during the war. Some people say there are a few episodes of it. Some people say none at all. Although the consensus is he obviously does fine, so to mischaracterize him as a drunk would be pretty foolish. But he gets out of the army, and he's sort of pulled back into the service because he happens to be a person who knows how to be a mustering officer. And then he gets a regiment, and then he gets various opportunities. He makes the most of them, but all of these things are kind of happenstance and strangely random. Unlike Lee, who's second in his class. Scott wants him to take command of the army very early in the war. He has this tremendously distinguished career, not just in Mexico, but throughout the rest of it. But Grant, obviously, there's a lot of randomness involved in this. Right? So that's something to consider about when you evaluate the question of are there good generals or not. Now, why would an institution like the Naval Academy tend to want to focus, though, on generalship? What is it about our mission here? Yes, right. I mean, what would it do to the Naval Academy's own self-conception if all of our classes talked about, well, you know, there are all these institutional and contextual and bureaucratic factors, and a lot of it's just blind luck, right? So why might especially the folks at Bancroft Hall be just a little concerned if that's what I was telling you all the time?
Didn't want to choose this institution.
Yeah. All right. Also, how might it be? How might it hurt? Even if all those statements are true, how might it hurt the organization if everyone just thinks of, you know, it's really context that matters? It's really
you develop people who are passive and become victims of their environment.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Have any of you heard of Clausewitz's concept of friction? Maybe. Okay, Mr. Goodman.
Yes, sir. It's the fog of war.
Yes. Right. That in wars, even simplest things become difficult because wars are so plagued by uncertainty, by chance, and also fear, right? And people are getting killed, and things just don't quite seem to work right a lot of times. And also, there are very human things. We'll have a staff ride, an optional staff ride in this class, but when we go to Spotsylvania, I'll point out things like, and you get this more when you study individual battles, people get tired. People get, they run on too little sleep. They're asked to make decisions of incredible importance. and that's why mistakes are made. Stonewall Jackson's a great example of this. What happens to him? He's shot by his own men. Right. We'll talk a little bit about this when I do Spotsylvania, but Longstreet, if you know, is shot near where Jackson is shot by his own men. Even after being warned by Lee, be careful, you know what happened around here. It's almost as Longstreet goes out on a patrol to do reconnaissance, right? You don't have satellite imagery. You've got to go look at the stuff yourself. It's night. It's confusing, right? He comes back, makes noise, and his own guys shoot him, right? And Longstreet eventually recovers, but I think he's shot through the neck. He's actually out of commission for the Overland campaign, right? So these are the kinds of random things that happen, right? And in Clausewitz's view, Clausewitz calls it, you know, it's friction versus genius. It's related to this issue of character. And by the way, well, Mr. Goodman, where did you hear of friction before?
Where else? We had to do reading for warfare on Clausewitz.
Okay. All right. The Marine Corps is really into this, actually. All right. For Clausewitz, what... And this is partly because Clausewitz himself had been a serving general and a serving officer. One of the main way, and this partly because he's intellectually he's a 19th century romantic German, is that one of the ways you overcome friction, right? And by friction he's using a concept, it's like a machine, right, where all the gears get gummed up, right? You guys are in the naval services. This is a perfect, right? You might be, Mr. Connors might be having to lubricate things to make them work one day, right? Or telling a chief to do it, or telling a chief who then tells someone else to do it, right? That's probably the way it's going
to
work.
Tell the chief,
right?
To tell someone else to do it.
So, all right, so, because you guys are officers, right? So, how do you overcome that friction? How do you overcome the inherent problems of getting even the most basic things done? Well, For Clausewitz, in large part, it's by force of will, right? And you can look, some of you already mentioned it. That's always been an argument for Grant's. That's why Grant's tenacity seeing is a virtue, right? Something goes wrong, but something always goes wrong, and he finds a way to overcome it. Right. And that is the ethic we try to teach you here, right? Something goes wrong, but what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to just give up and give excuses? No, right? You're supposed to, well, I hope that you're not supposed to do that, right? But here's something I want you to think about, though. This is an academic history class. This is not a leadership class, right? And I'm not saying that the people who teach that as leadership are wrong. But one thing you might want to ask yourself at times is that really true, right? I mean, is that, in fact, the correct way? Is that really how things occur? And that arguably is a different question. You can still make that compatible, in all honesty, with giving your all and trying to overcome things as best you can and seeing that. But that's arguably more a moral and ethical issue than one that's a historical. There are different types of historical explanations. All right. So does everyone see what I'm saying here? There's potentially one's professional ethic. You have that because of moral and ethical reasons. Whether or not that is always operative in terms of the way of explaining history correctly is actually a different issue, and is actually much more complicated. All right. So, and that's something you should consider, right? Because you see, do you guys still do Hobson's Law and things like that as a plebe? Or was it not Hobson's? I think I used to give this to plebe summer. I think it's a story. I can't remember when. It's of a destroyer captain. Something terribly goes wrong. I forget. The ship sinks. He's not, he's asleep in his cabin, but he ends up having to take risks. I think he goes down with the ship, right? And why does he have to do that, why are CEOs relieved even if it's the subordinates who screw up?
They're responsible.
Yeah, they have ultimate. Now, someone give me an argument against that.
Every time things go wrong, the CEO's in his room.
Yeah, how can you always guarantee, what if it's a brand new ensign, right? What if it's a...
Been doing it without having a qualified OOD,
and that's exactly the
which would have been signed off by the CO,
yes,
which in
exactly,
fact would have
right.
Given
so,
the authority.
And that is the Navy's ethic, right? That, and that's to make sure that every commanding officer gives his or her all in taking these responsibilities seriously. I mean, that's arguably you have to do that as an organization. All right, do any of you, what was the most controversial thing that happened amongst Marines in Afghanistan recently? The thing that ended up on YouTube?
You're an idiot.
Yeah. What do you think is probably going to happen to the company commander?
EDX.
Yeah, I think everyone's actually moved on, but I don't think that person's career is going to go anywhere after this, in all honesty. All right, I'm just saying that as I have no real information about what. But why do you think that's going to be? What if? But can he supervise every little thing that happens?
Nobody's responsible for it.
Right. He creates the culture.
Exactly, and that's the ethic, right? But he's still responsible for the culture. He's still responsible for making sure his NCOs. And the military as an organization takes that ethic on very seriously. All right. Okay. But again, that is a professional imperative. Right. Is that the best historical explanation for things like whether or not a whole country or army wins in a war or not? Maybe not. Maybe not. Right. Can you still... You see how those are different, right? This is a question of causality versus a question of professional ethics. That being said, most military historians take the view of that generals do matter. So they'll talk about things like loss of nerve, right? And sometimes they'll be incredibly critical about them, right? And there'll be sort of the military historian's version of Monday morning quarterbacking, kind of, right? So it's almost similar to rhetoric. You know, poor Joe Flacco. See what happens. You know, how is he always criticized? But is that really fair? I mean, it's things like that. All right. So now I want to throw this back. I want to come back to Grant, though. Grant, what do you think? Good general, bad general? I know I didn't really give you the case against him.
Great general.
Okay. Any dissenters? Anyone who wants to try to push back on that? Or construct an argument. Or maybe even if you don't believe it, just... Yes?
Kind of argument made. I mean, pretty much like his strategy was just to, like, keep throwing more bodies at it until he won. Because he realized, like, well, we have more men than they do. So, you know, like, it was one battle he lost, like, 7,000 people in, like, what, like, 2 hours? So, I mean, you know...
Yeah, that's Cold Harbor. We don't think it's quite that bad. But there are plenty of things you can criticize Grant for during the Overland campaign. We now think that's actually an exaggeration.
So, I mean, he's argued that he really didn't, like, look at his men. He looked at them more as, like, his objects and really, like, people. Like, my focus is to win the war, don't really care about the casualties.
And I think Weigley, by the way, kind of subscribes to that view.
I wouldn't say he doesn't care about his people. I would say more he has the hierarchy of, like, mission and then, you know, on down, understanding that he has to get a task done, knowing that he has to put forth these maneuvers that put his people at risk. And there's also arguments and, like, war theory that, you know, if you love your men, you allow them to go forth and fight. Where, like, McClellan's argument was like, oh, I love my men, I don't want to put them in the face of danger. Well, they were itching to go out and fight. So do you love your men that you're not trusting in their ability to go forth? So, I mean, I think that's just a matter of who was really in Grant's head and knows how they felt.
Mr. Goodman, let's look at other people in on this question. There's some very interesting points coming up now.
I was going to agree with her, actually. I feel that there are things that, while his men might have said that he didn't care for them because he threw them at certain situations, they also don't, being a regular private or corporal in an infantry, you don't get the strategy. You only see the tactics. So while they may see that he's throwing bodies at a certain level, they're also not seeing that he's choosing to skip certain battles and move on to certain other things and not picking every single battle across the line in order to rack up wins, but overall get a victory on strategy.
Let me just put it. From what we know of Grant's reputation among his troops, he was, generally historians think that he was not loved. You sometimes know this by nicknames that generals get, right? So Sherman's called Uncle Billy. Lee's called Marse Robert. McClellan was called Little Mac. Right, and it's not you. It's very, very much a fond. I mean, people supposedly he'd have these big parades, and they'd actually like parades. Not unlike, well, I know you guys all love parades. You guys live for parades, right? And McClellan would he was a great horseman, and he'd sort of do a flourish, and his troops would go crazy, and really, that's seriously true. The sense amongst historians is Grant never got that kind of nickname, but he still had a lot of, you know, he's very respected, right? And that's a different issue, right? I mean, but the question of whether or not that's an index of effectiveness. McClellan's loved, of course. McClellan arguably is not as good a general, right? But that's let me just point that out. Mr. Connors, let me get you
in. There's kind of a Patton-esque element there, you know, old blood and guts. So yeah, you kind of
grinds the hell out of you, but at the same time, he gets victories.
Yes,
so that's,
right.
That's what you appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, soldiers generally, we know from history generally that troops are willing to fight, especially if they know they're going to win. They're willing to take loss. I mean, but the trade-off has to be they have to have a sense that they're winning or getting something out of it. So, yeah.
I get the kind of sense that the Confederacy was already capitulating a bit, and Grant just gave the final push. Maybe not so much that, I mean, I'm not attempting to disprove that he's this amazing strategist, but I feel like maybe too much credit is given to
okay.
him. Maybe the South had already shot itself in the foot.
And at the end of the Overland campaign, is the Lincoln administration's political situation in great shape? No. I mean, people are terribly disappointed at the end of the summer of 1864. And what, do you remember what battle is? What changes it?
It's Sherman.
Of course, though, the argument then is Grant deserves some credit for that, because Grant is the one who puts in motion the strategy that involves moving in different avenues of advance, right? And one of those is Sherman. And also, Grant has limitations. Some of his advances he's planning are fail because of inept field commanders. The bench of effective field commanders is very low, and Grant has political imperatives he has to respect. Okay, but that's a good subtle argument of too much credit.
Another reason that he kept his job, and you mentioned Lincoln, is Lincoln was just so thrilled to have a general that was at least aggressive. And Lincoln also had more of the annihilation theory. Like, he wanted his generals to attack Lee's army, not necessarily take Richmond, which I know McClellan was more about trying to take Richmond. So it lined up better, and Lincoln needed somebody who would do something,
okay.
whether he won or not.
And that's maybe not so much Grant's doing as it is Lincoln's. Right, Mr. Connors.
I think Grant's biggest failings are tactical, not strategic. I think everybody can agree that he's strategically very good, but tactically less so. And perfect example of that, again, is Wilderness and Sharpsburg. Because Wilderness, again, he gets his flanks turned. So that generally denotes bad tactical skills.
And Cold Harbor would also certainly be a
Cold Harbor, example. the Battle of the Angle.
Well, but that's not Grant, right? You're thinking of Sharpsburg. You're thinking of Antietam.
Sharpsburg.
Same thing.
Yes.
Antietam. McClellan. 62. September.
Spotsylvania.
Okay, the angle. All right, that. Okay, yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. You can certainly criticize the way we'll walk that ground, or those of you on the staff, right? But the way the assaults are made are open to question. All right. Although in Grant's defense, is it Grant's job to be doing tactical level stuff?
No, it's supposed to be Meade.
It's supposed to be his staff and Meade, and so there's arguably an organizational issue there, as much as anything else. All right. I mean, it's Grant. Part of Grant's struggle in the Overland campaign is, and this is not clear in the readings you have, Grant has two very different and profoundly conflicting hats. He is, in effect, the field commander in a very awkward commander relationship with Meade. He is the field commander in the field of the Army of Potomac, fighting Lee. But what else is he supposed to do? And Weigley talks a lot about it. He is coordinating all the federal armies. All right. This is as if General Dempsey had to do his job as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff while being in Afghanistan as the ISAF commander. Right. Why do we not do things that way?
Their visas affecting us.
Yeah. It's too much for one person. It's really too much for one person. Right. It's kind of absurd. But the American system is bureaucratically has all sorts of weird quirks in it. This is one of the quirks of it. Right. This is why Halleck is such a failure at the end of the day, we think. Because Halleck should have played that role of keeping the big picture. And you guys, Halleck was a great, there are really not that many great American military writers in the pre-Civil War period, but Halleck's the best you've got, pretty much. All right. Well, there's Dennis Hart Mahong up at West Point, but he's too old. So Halleck's the only one in uniform. And he doesn't do that. And Grant eventually takes up that role. So you can make, in his defense, he's kind of pulled in too many different directions. And that's one of the reasons why you get some of these failings. I do want to come back, though, to Mr. Nye's point. I mean, arguably there is sometimes a conflict, though, between McClellan is loved by his men, but can you love your men too much? Does that make you a... I mean, do people really buy that? Or is this different types of... Well, okay, let me let you discuss it, Mr. Roth.
Well, it's related to sports. If you're going to play, like, shy and all that, you're going to get hurt. So if you're not aggressive and you're not taking the fight to them, it's going to be more, you're going to hurt yourself worse because when the attack does come, you're not going to be ready for it. So building on Grant, like always pushing, always being aggressive, looking for the right fight and all that. Like he was protecting his men. Well, McClellan was kind of like, oh, I don't want to go there and all that. So when a big fight did come, they weren't really ready for it.
All right. I mean, McClellan does take a lot of casualties also. I mean, and he doesn't get much for it. I mean, that's an argument. How about Mr. Mallon?
And then also, I mean, like Christina said, I mean, these men enlisted to fight and obviously fight for something that they believed in or they were paid to do. And so by not allowing them to fight and, you know, by trying to protect their lives, I think McClellan and other generals were doing them a disservice because they didn't sign up to sit in camp or, you know, just wear the uniform. You know, in theory, they signed up to fight and to win battles. But
anyone want to?
Wasn't there a draft? Like, some of them were pressed in?
Yes, by 63. And then you have a lot of people who are, I think I mentioned this in the previous class, the draft works in part, not many men are directly conscripted, but what happens is states are given quotas, and they have to, they're incentivized, the states are incentivized to pay a lot of commutation money, a lot of bonus money.
And a lot of people, even though they were with the draft, they were able to get out of it by getting someone else to go.
Right, substitutes. So they're not all completely volunteers by this point in the war.
Didn't the draft come in after McClellan was already replaced?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but we're talking about Grant, right?
Right. Yeah, Manley's arguing that he's doing a disservice to his men by keeping them in camp when they wanted to fight, and then the counterpoint to that being the draft doesn't apply to McClellan.
Yeah, fair enough.
And then also, I mean, by not allowing them to fight and not allowing them to win battles, you could also argue that whoever does this is prolonging the war, which in the long term is losing more lives.
Okay, I mean there's kind of a conflict between short term and long term, and then it's not adjudicating it correctly. All right, that's okay. Anyone else want to, Mr. Roth?
By putting your men in a battle, you have trust in them. You have trust that they'll come through and win. And by like shying away, like they realize like, oh, general doesn't want us to fight this battle because he doesn't think we can win this one. And if that happens over and over again, like. Why would you like the group of misfits?
You guys are giving the very good institutional response, right? And it's perfectly defensible, but let me push back a little bit. All right. John Bell Hood. Okay. Incredibly aggressive. All right. Men quite fond of him. What happens? He destroys his own army, in effect. All right, by attacking. All right. I forget his name. My good friend and colleague Joe Glattar, who's a Civil War historian at UNC Chapel Hill, is a great one of his books. It's in the Western Army, in Sherman's Army, and he has here a story about I can't remember which one. It's a corps commander who's very effective, very aggressive, but somewhat disliked by his men because he's seen as a bit too aggressive, a bit too ambitious. Right. I mean, so there's a fine line between, troops want to win, and troops understand they have to do certain things to do that. But when do you have an officer who maybe wants that glory a little bit too much?
You also have to think about the different dynamic between the officers and how they got, or the generals and how they got in their position. So you've got your political generals who are there literally just to appease, you know, border states and people with their specific opinions. And then you've got the generals who are literally, like, militarily efficient. So you have to look at the different backgrounds and, like, how they got in those positions. Lincoln appoints people as political generals, and they've had no experience ever before, and they're leading green troops themselves. And then you've got people who are very, very familiar with battlefield tactics and things of that nature, and they're viewed as overly aggressive, but they're the ones who have the best knowledge and experience in the field. So who do you criticize?
Fair enough, although I'll point out that a lot of times political generals are in place because out of respect to the desires of the troops, right? I mean, if especially in these, you know, some of these controversial German immigrant generals, guys like Karl Schurz, Franz Sigel, all of whom have extraordinarily dubious military careers. But I fight Schmidt Sigel. That used to be the joke of what, you know, do you even get that? Yes, exactly, right? So, you know, a lot, they command German-speaking, you know, the German-speaking communities are actually politically quite important. A lot of them still use German. If you do serious antebellum political history, sometimes you have to learn German to read their newspapers in the U.S. Well, it depends on where you're working, like a place like St. Louis maybe. But, you know, the political, I mean, it's partly because out of respect to, I mean, all the reports are correct, but let me just, you know, point that out. You know, sometimes you have examples where this is kind of a conflict. I mean, I don't that, you know, at times negotiating the gap between the potential conflict between concern for one's troops, what the troops want to do, and overall mission accomplishment, maybe there may be a conflict there, right? And there may be a way to square it in the long view on the big view, but this may look much more ambiguous. And I've seen this in counterinsurgency settings, right? So do you think all senior NCOs are really filled with all these restrictions on escalation of force and ROE and stuff like that? No, they're not. No, I've seen, and these are platoon sergeants who do what they're told to do, but who are like, they don't like these rules. And what does the officer have to do? Enforce them, right? I mean, a lot of times the marker of a good unit is when the especially the NCO's modern unit, is when they do stuff that they don't want to do, but they still do it. They'll grumble a little bit, especially if it's a senior non-com who's having a private conversation with his company commander or something like that. But what do they do at the end of the day? They care, yeah. That's the ethic that's taught, and that's more or less the ethics that's been absorbed, especially in high-quality organizations. But there is a, you know, but there is a conflict. I mean, you shouldn't. I mean, I don't want you to think, you know, these things can get very messy on the ground. And historically, that's certainly the case too. Right. Okay, so here's a question. A lot of times, historians also phrase that. I think the consensus view of all in all honesty, Lee was pretty good. Also, I mean, it's although there's more of a debate. Although perhaps that's just because Lee lost, right? So he's more open to criticism because he was the guy on the losing side. And Grant's harder to criticize because if you can say all these bad things about Grant, but what does he do at the end of the day? He wins, right? Maybe he wins ugly, but he wins, right? So a lot of times the debate comes down to, did he win too ugly? Could he have won at a more efficient rate, whatever that means? All that being said, who here thinks that Lee is superior to Grant? Who here would take Lee over Grant? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10. Who takes Grant? And then you have the right to abstain.
Is this as a commander in chief or a...
The better general, whatever that means, your own criteria.
A bar fight.
No, not in a bar fight. As in, and of course, midshipmen would never involve themselves Grant in such activities. Or who would take Grant over Lee?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
I think there's an 8. There's people. All right, 8 or 9. Okay, well, it's by, all right, Lee by nose. That's interesting. All right, I'm a little bit surprised by that, but.
You need to do one of the simulator mashups.
Oh, yeah.
Probably on the History Channel.
No.
Spike TV.
God, yeah.
All right, okay. I'll see you guys on Monday, Mr. Guerra. All right, see you. Have a good weekend.
I think the bigger like consideration here is level set.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, it would.
Lectures in History airs each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. We feature classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. To keep up with American History TV during the week, or to send us your questions and comments, follow us on Twitter. We're at twitter.com/cspanhistory.